You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
$4 billion. That's how much a lawsuit claims the state of Michigan shortchanges local government every year. The suit says the state's using accounting gimmicks to violate the Headley Amendment. The lawsuit was filed today by a group of attorneys and local government officials. Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is here to tell us more. And Rick, we have heard local municipalities complaining for years that they're being shortchanged in state revenue sharing. This lawsuit really takes things to a whole new level. What's going on?
Oh, it absolutely takes things to a new level. A group of local government officials, these are all from Macomb County, but presumably more could join up if they wanted, and some public interest lawyers, they say the state's been playing a shell game with revenue sharing payments to local governments to the tune of $4 billion a year, as you just said, and basically shifting the state's budget troubles to the locals. And they say in some cases, this has helped drive local governments into emergency management. So they want the state to stop doing it, maybe even pay back all or some of that money.
Well, tell us about this shell game.
The state divvies up state sales tax revenue between schools, municipal governments, counties, and what the state keeps. And basically, this lawsuit says the state has been cheating under the terms of the Headley Amendment to the state constitution. Now, that amendment, it both limits tax increases, but it also limits the things the state can require local governments to do without ponying up the money. And I spoke with the lead attorney on the case. His name is John Moak. He is a Wayne State University law professor and an expert on the Michigan Constitution. Here's what he says is going on.
Over many years, over 20 years or more, the state has been shifting the tax burden to local governments. It's been reducing its proportion of revenue sharing, and it has been imposing obligations on local governments that it's not reporting and it's not taking into account. And accordingly, revenue sharing to local governments has gone down in violation of the Constitution.
So break this down for us, Rick. What are the state constitutional questions at stake here?
Okay, what the lawsuit says is that the state has been ripping off local governments in four specific ways since the 1990s, when everything was changed by the state starting to use the sales tax to help pay for schools under Proposal A. And that is, they say that payments to school districts have been counted against revenue sharing. Payments to charter schools have been counted against local government revenue sharing. Payments to counties for some major trunk lines that are actually the responsibility of the state to pay for have been counted against revenue sharing. And it says there are mandates the state has imposed on local governments that the state has to pay for under the Headley Amendment, but it's actually double dealing by counting that as a part of revenue sharing. And then just to kind of cap it, it also says that the state should be doing a better job of keeping track of those mandates, and it hasn't been.
So if I'm the mayor of a city or town where spending has been cut to the bone and beyond, and I'm listening to you and me talking about this, my ears are perked up. What could this lawsuit mean for my city?
What this lawsuit could mean for your city is, first of all, that you could be getting more money under the revenue sharing scheme. And that's what, you know, cities and counties have been saying should have been happening for a while. And then it could be vindication of their position that the legislature and governors, and this has been both under Republican and Democratic control, remember, that they've been doing it wrong for a really long time, that they've been violating not just the spirit of revenue sharing by keeping more than their fair share, but also the letter of what they were supposed to be doing under the Michigan Constitution.
So let's talk about what comes next. Where was the suit filed, and what are we going to watch for?
The suit was filed in the Michigan Court of Appeals. That's where Headley Amendment cases go automatically. And the next step is for the state to look at this lawsuit and file its response. And then we'll see where it goes from there.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta with this breaking news. Rick, as always, thanks so much.
Oh, glad to do it.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
There was a probable cause conference today for the eight defendants charged by Attorney General Bill Schuette in the Flint water disaster. Just what does that mean, and how does today's hearing fit into this legal process? Wayne State University law professor Peter Henning is back with us. Peter, just what is a probable cause conference?
Well, it's the first step after defendants have been charged. It's an opportunity for the government to say what it's going to do to establish probable cause that these defendants committed the crimes they're accused of. And for the defendant, it's their first chance to really see the government unveil its case, how it plans to prosecute them if the case gets to trial.
So we should refresh everyone's memory here. At the end of July, the Attorney General filed criminal charges against six state employees, Michigan Department of Health and Human Services employees Nancy Peeler, Corinne Miller, and Robert Scott, and from the Department of Environmental Quality, Leanne Schechter-Smith, Adam Rosenthal, and Patrick Cook. And then back in April, the AG announced felony charges against DEQ officials Stephen Bush and Mike Prisby, as well as City of Flint employee Mike Glasgow, but he pleaded no contest to a misdemeanor, and he's cooperating with the investigation, and other charges were dropped. So we have eight people at this probable cause conference. What are the main tasks now? If you represented any of these defendants, what would you be doing going forward?
Well, from here, the question is, does the government have enough evidence for the case to be bound over for trial? So at this preliminary phase, you don't have to prove a defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It's just, is there enough evidence for probable cause? In other words, essentially a reasonable belief that each of the defendants committed the crimes they're accused of. As a defense lawyer, what I want to do is I want to start to spot weaknesses in the government's case, and especially if I can see any legal weaknesses, that might be a basis for me to challenge the charge before we ever get to trial. So it's really for the defense lawyers a chance to explore the government's case without really revealing any of their case.
And if I'm on the Attorney General's team, my main mission is?
Get this case bound over for trial. You've got to put on enough evidence to convince the district judge that there is probable cause that these defendants committed the crime. And it's always a challenge for the prosecutor because you have to put on a good enough case, but you don't want to unveil your entire case. In that regard, it's a little bit like the preseason in any sport, that you've got to put on something there, but you don't unveil everything.
Almost like a legal poker game. I don't want to put the whole hand out on the table.
Right. You don't want to reveal everything, and you want to be careful not to expose your witnesses and put on too many witnesses, because every time a witness testifies, that becomes cannon fodder for the defense to cross-examine them at trial. And so, of course, the lawyers are going to look for any inconsistency, and people don't say the same thing twice. So it may be something innocuous, but it could be something important. And so as a prosecutor, I don't want to create evidence that could be used against one of my witnesses. So I have to be careful in that regard.
Assuming that the judge today says, yes, I do find probable cause to proceed, then what comes next?
Then it's off to trial. That's the next formal proceeding. Now, there will be, between the preliminary exam and the trial, there will be challenges, and I expect most, if not all, the defendants to challenge the charges and say that even if everything the government says is true, we didn't commit the crime, especially, for example, the misconduct in office charge that is filed against, if not all of them, at least almost all of them. There are some tough legal issues in there that the Attorney General's office has to overcome. Those will be decided initially before trial, but ultimately this is going to end up one way or another in the Court of Appeals.
Peter Henning is a law professor at Wayne State University. Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's court hearing in Flint resulted in preliminary examination dates being set for all eight defendants. The preliminary examinations will be done in three batches, starting next January 18th and running through April 3rd. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How do you express your feelings after a team of experts sits you down to tell you that your child is developmentally disabled? Janice Fialka of Huntington Woods came home reeling from such a case conference about her then 5-year-old son, Micah. She sat down and tried to put her feelings into words. The result, a poem that Janice calls Advice to Professionals Who Must Conference Cases.
Before the case conference, I would look at my almost 5-year-old son and see a golden-haired boy who giggled at his baby sister's attempt to clap her hands, who charmed adults by his spontaneous hugs and hellos, who captured his parents with his rapture with music, and his care for white-haired people who walked to walk a bit slower than younger folks, who often became a legend in places visited because of his exquisite ability to befriend a few special souls, and who, at the age of 4, went to the Detroit Public Library requesting a book on Martin Luther King. After the case conference, I looked at my almost 5-year-old son. He seemed to have lost his golden hair. I saw only words plastered on his face, words that drowned us in fear, words like primary expressive speech and language disorder, severe visual motor delay, sensory integration dysfunction, fine and gross motor delay, developmental dyspraxia, and Ritalin now. I want my son back. That's all. I want him back now. Then I'll get on with my life.
And that she did. Janice and her family, husband Rich, daughter Emma, and son Micah, launched themselves on a mission to prove that labels, IQ tests, do not measure someone's ability to be valuable to the world, to contribute, to learn. Her book is titled What Matters, Reflections on Disability, Community, and Love. Janice, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. I'm really glad to be here.
That was an incredibly heavy storm of labels and diagnoses that you were given about your boy, and little boy, Micah. And yeah, you quickly realized that being labeled developmentally disabled could have really kept Micah from being included not only in the classroom but in the world beyond. And you pushed and pushed for inclusion.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, I think he pushed as much as we pushed. You know, there's this sort of famous story in our family when he was in first grade. He was in a self-contained or a segregated classroom. And he, you know, with a great teacher, committed, caring, he came home one day, tugged on my shirt, looked at me, and with somewhat limited language said, "I want to go in the same door as all my other friends." Wham.
Wow.
You know, talk about having a dream. He knew that he belonged with his peers. And so we've been following him through the same door, through same windows, cracking through whatever we needed to make sure that he was with his peers, always with the right supports as well.
And when you went to the school to say, guess what, Micah doesn't want to be in that classroom. He wants to be in the door with everybody he knows. How was that received?
Yeah. Well, I think initially people scratched their head. I mean, there were young people who were in the building who were mainstreamed in for art classes or gym classes. So they were nudging in that direction, but Micah was really the first one. So I think everybody was nervous, scared. They quickly learned that we weren't going to budge on that aspect, that we really were committed to full inclusion, as it is called. And so we really sought out resources and people. It was at a time when inclusion was really coming full force, and so there were a lot of trainings available. And we really, a big part of it is we met regularly to talk about how do we do this? What's not working? What's working? How do we support Micah?
And that approach got you right through grade school, middle school, high school, and all the way on to college to Oakland University.
Yes.
Would you have seen that happening back in that first push in first grade?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, initially what we always say is in the very beginning, we did something that was pretty dangerous. We stopped dreaming. You know, when we first got all those labels, we stopped thinking about the future. And quickly we were able to connect with a lot of people who really told stories and helped us understand that really people with labels can live a very meaningful life. So we had to rebuild those dreams. And gradually, you know, Micah became part of that new wave of students with what we call intellectual disabilities, formerly known as mental retardation, who wanted to go to college because that's what most of his peers did. So, of course, he wanted to do that. And, you know, at first we thought, well, this is a big door to open up because kids with supposedly IQs of 40, Micah didn't read or write in a typical way, use technology. So initially that was a shock to everybody. I mean, they sort of have thought we were in denial. You forgot that your child has these limits. And as my husband beautifully said, we weren't in denial. We were in hope.
There you go. What a difference.
Yes.
Now, you did hit a you got him into Oakland University,
yes,
and he proceeded along coursework. He had assistance as he went through, but
yes,
he was a student. But you did hit a pretty formidable roadblock when Micah realized he wanted to be in a dorm with his friends. Talk to us about what it
yes
took to make that happen.
Yes, yes. Well, Oakland University created a really absolutely excellent program for many students with intellectual disabilities. Mike was thriving there. It was a force on campus. He has this well-known smile. And when he saw, after being there for about 4 or 5 years, taking 2 buses up Woodward every day and 2 buses back, he saw his sister move into the dorm, and he began to know what a dorm is. You know, he had this rich opportunity. And so he said, that's what I want to do. I want the full college experience, he said. And he wanted to move in the dorm. And the university initially said yes, and then we get a phone call one day saying that decision has been rescinded, and because Mike is not officially a matriculated student, he cannot live in the dorm. And Mike has a circle of friends, people who meet with him on a regular basis to support him, help him make decisions. So that meeting, that gathering, happened to be on that same day. And so the students and some of the professors said, well, what are we going to do about this, Micah? Should be able to live in the dorm. And so they, with Micah's support, did a petition. They held rallies on the campus. He met with the administration. He spoke in front of the board of trustees. He was committed, and he's a peacemaker, so we weren't quite sure how he was going to deal with this. And they kept saying no, and so he decided that he was going to sue the university.
He decided.
Yes, he did. And we supported him. We also let him know that if, you know, at some point it was getting too much, that would be okay. You know, we really want him to make mm-hmm. his decisions. So he worked with Michigan Protection and Advocacy, a state fund or federally funded program. They were wonderful. 2 years of battles, if you will, depositions. Judge Duggan ruled in favor of Micah, and Micah moved in and had a fabulous semester living on campus.
Now, has that changed? Did that decision open doors all over Michigan for other students to be in dorms?
Not so much in Michigan, but certainly now there are over 300 fully inclusive college programs across the country. Federally, there's a lot of federal dollars behind this. Many of the universities have include students in the dorm life as well.
I'm talking with author Janice Fialka. Her book, What Matters, Reflections on Disability, Community, and Love. And it really is the story of how the entire family, including her son, Micah, push for inclusion from first grade right on up. And take us to where Micah is now.
Yes.
He
yes.
is how old and where is he?
Micah's 32 years old. Hard to believe. So Micah does speak nationally about his life. Mm-hmm. So Micah's storytelling is important to inspire families, teachers, professionals. So he was speaking on the campus of Syracuse University, which I will remind you is 7 hours away. Mm-hmm. And he was there for an entire week for 2 conferences. And this is a true story. He called home and said, "They understand me here, Mom. The next door I want to open is Syracuse University." And so we listened. He created a circle of friends in Syracuse before he moved there. And he was able to secure a job at the university. He is a teaching assistant in a class in the School of Education. So you have young people who are preparing to be teachers with Micah there as a, in the role of a teaching assistant, a TA. So the message is loud and clear. Do not limit your expectations of kids with any kind of label. Use your imagination for what might be possible. So if you walk across the campus at various points, as we did with Micah, you will hear people say, "Hey, Professor Micah, Yeah, it's stunning. And so how does that happen? With a lot of opportunities. Mike is fortunate. He's not, I mean, he's a wonderful kid. I love him immensely. I respect him. But he's not exceptional. What has been exceptional is that he has opportunities. We've learned the power of asking for help. We know that advocacy is needs to be consistent. You have to persevere. You have to keep pushing.
And don't let the labels and the IQ test make you sit back down in a corner.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
What have you learned about strengthening the partnership between families and educators? And by that, I'm wondering, what can school districts do to respond to the needs of their students with disabilities when budgets are stretched tight? Does it take money or does it take a change in attitude?
Yes, right. Well, I think it takes a strong commitment to see that all children belong. And that there isn't a, that's your student and this is my student. So the concept of all children learning together has to be at the forefront. Doing inclusion is hard work. Anytime you try to meet the individual needs of a variety of students with or without IEPs or educational plans, it's going to take work. So I think that a strong leadership that believes that in inclusion is important. You know, another aspect is the power of reflection, that if you have families and professionals and eventually as a student gets older, sitting in a circle, talking about what's working, what isn't working, so much more can happen. I think sometimes we shy away from what we when we feel inadequate or when there's fear. I think one other thing is that sometimes when inclusion isn't done well, when there isn't the supports, then it gets a bad reputation. But it's not the inclusion that's not working. It's the way it's being set up.
What would you say to that parent at the beginning of the journey that you were on all these years ago? Now your son is 32. And when you think of what's transpired since he was just a little fella, just before he was five, and you had that conference and you heard those labels and thought, oh my word, where do we go now? What do you say to those parents who are right there now?
Acknowledge your feelings. That's a really important part to this journey, is not to deny the worry, the shame even, as awkward it is to say that. I mean, we've all been taught that disability is something you want to overcome. You know, we're living in a different era now where people are involved in disability pride efforts, knowing that disability is a part of who you are. It defines you. So the feelings are important to acknowledge those. And then reaching out and finding people who can support that vision, learning to invite help. I think we all spent so much time trying not to ask for help that if we just said, hey, I'm stuck here, what can I do? So I think that's it. And valuing interdependency. We can't do this alone. So those are some of my thoughts.
Wonderful book with a lot of inspiration. What Matters? Reflections on Disability, Community, and Love by Janice Fialka. It is great talking with you, Janice, and thank you so much for sharing Micah's story in this book and being with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia. It means a lot. Appreciate it.
Janice Fialka will be signing her book at some events this month, and that includes an event at the University of Michigan School of Education this coming Friday, September 9th. For more information and links to the book, you can visit their Facebook page, What Matters, Reflections on Disability, Community, and Love, or go to our website at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It has taken more than 30 years, but Ron Fournier has found his way home to Detroit. After a career that took him from Detroit to Hot Springs, where he covered a young Arkansas governor named Bill Clinton, and then on to Washington, where he built a national political reporting career at the Associated Press, the National Journal, and the Atlantic, Ron is back in Detroit. This is week one of his new job as associate publisher of Crain's Detroit Business. Ron Fournier, welcome.
Thanks for having me. How are you doing?
Great. Ron, I follow you on Twitter, and it is extremely clear you are really enjoying your homecoming. I saw a photo that you posted of Dumichel Art Galleries, and you wrote, parked cars here in high school, and now I'm living down the street. It feels good to be back home?
It does. Yeah, I valet parked at the Art Gallery years ago. Last night I got done with work, and met my sister for dinner downtown, and she works down here. It's just great. We've been talking about doing this for years. It's about time we got it done.
Now, you left Detroit after graduating from the University of Detroit. I've got to throw that in because we both went to what was then U of D.
Go Titans.
That's right. So you left in 85. You've had so many years of political reporting at that high national level. What brings you back to Detroit, to Michigan?
Two things, and to be honest with you, first is we just want to be home. We want to be, my wife and I both went to U of D. Our families are all based in and around Detroit and have been for generations. And then I was lucky enough to find an opportunity in journalism that would stretch my muscles a bit, help me learn the business side of journalism, and get me involved in writing and being involved in covering a truly dynamic story, and that is the rebirth of Detroit. I've spent, you know, the last 25 years in political journalism and the last 10 or so in a very depressing, stagnant, status quo driven story in Washington. Well, here I get to cover, you know, there's some really important people who are working together to get some important things done. And I'm anxious to be a part of that.
Detroit is right where you feel there is a big story to tell in terms of reinvention and resurgence.
Exactly. And it's what's not happening in Washington. We have stasis and an amazing lack of disruption in an era when all of our institutions are either being wiped away or are severely adapting. And our two parties and our political system has not been changing in the to adapt to the way we've been forced to change as a people. And you know, Detroit is changing. Now it's not all for the good, and it certainly hasn't come back all the way yet, and it's going to take a long time for it to reinvent itself if it does. But at least there's progress. At least, you know, for the first time in my lifetime, you've got the business and political leaders working together to try to keep pushing forward. And it's a great story to cover. It's not all positive, but it's not all negative and depressing, which is, you know, what you get in Washington.
You know, it must have been I don't know what even the word is, curious in a sense or emotional for you to be there in Washington as Detroit was going through that bankruptcy, seeing your hometown on the national or even really the international stage.
Yeah, it was really maddening because you'd had so many people who've never been to Detroit using Detroit as their punching bag, trying to pretend that the problems Detroit has faced were because of one party or because of one race or because of one this or one that. I did use the opportunity to write quite a bit about Detroit and try to explain that Detroit is a microcosm for the rest of the country, that a lot of the institutional decline and a lot of the changes that we're not adapting to as quickly as we need to in society that have hurt Detroit. The very complex series, a confluence of things that have hurt Detroit over the last 40 or 50 years are emblematic nationwide. And Detroit could be not just an emblematic for the decline of the country in the last half of the 20th century, but could be a model for the rebirth of this entire country and the reinvention of this entire country for another great American century. So that's the story I try to tell from Washington. And again, not all airy-fairy and puffy. Not everyone is benefiting from what's happening here. It still has a long way to go, but at least it's going. And I would like more people outside of Detroit to come to Detroit and write and see what's really happening here instead of, you know, regurgitating cliches.
I have to say, Ron Furrier, it was kind of interesting. You may have left Washington in politics, but you noted very acutely on Twitter on Labor Day, politics didn't leave you. You tweeted, my first full day in Detroit and Bill Clinton is marching in the Labor Day parade nearby. We can't quit each other.
Yeah, well, I've covered him since our days in Arkansas together. The day before, Donald Trump, who I've been very hard on, as a candidate and a person. He was in Detroit the day before, yeah. Pretending that he was reaching out to African Americans. So, I'll stay active and interested in national politics. I'll write a little bit for Atlantic from time to time, and I'll look for ways to bring my experience in national politics to bear in Detroit. But I will not forget every day that I really don't know the city. I've been gone for a long time. I've got a lot to learn about the city and the business community and the political community. And that's what's exciting for me professionally, because I'd like to learn every day I come to work. And I kind of figured out Washington. It's a pretty non-complex place because it's basically a duopoly. It's basically two parties who are working together to not get anything done. Detroit is so much more complex. Southeast Michigan is so much more complex. The state of Michigan, the politics and policy are so fascinating. And I'm, you know, now I get to, as an old dog, I get to learn some new tricks.
Ron Fournier, back in Detroit as associate publisher of Crain's Detroit Business. Thanks for spending time with us today on Stateside.
Thank you for having me. Let's do this again and go Titans.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
There is no doubt college expenses are rising. Trying to pay for tuition, books, a place to live, food, all of that can stretch a budget beyond its breaking point. A senior criminal justice student at Ferris State knows that struggle, and she's seen it on her campus. And that's why Olivia Johnson began the Student Emergency Food Pantry for Ferris Students. Olivia, how did you come up with this idea of a food pantry for students?
I'm actually active in a lot of mission work throughout the year. I've been to places like New York, North Carolina. I've even been to Haiti, where I've seen more than one need from the community, but also even here at Ferris State, I've seen the struggle and the need of students when it comes to food and not being able to afford room and board. I actually jumped on this task when I heard the story of a young man who could only afford to eat a slice of pizza a day, which would be a box of Little Caesars a week. And through that, I decided to do something about it, and I wanted to do my part for our community and just let people know that I understand where their pain is coming from, and I understand their need, and I just wanted to act on it.
And so how much food could a student get, and how does someone qualify?
As far as qualifications, there aren't any, as long as you're a fair student. So when you arrive to the pantry, you must have your student ID, and there is a simple form to fill out just so that we can understand who we're talking to here, whether or not, you know, you're a student, what level of your education you're in, whether you're on campus or off campus. And after you fill out that form, you are able to get food. We supply you with up to a week and a half worth of food. So we give you a lot of, like, rice and noodles and pasta, soups. We give you cereal, pancake mix, and things of that sort, things that last a pretty long time.
And where did you get the food items, donations or funding?
So we actually, my campus director and I actually partnered up and we wrote grant proposals to the Board of Higher Education, and we received a $2,500 grant, and we went out and we purchased the food. But beforehand, I attempted to establish partnerships with places like Walmart and Meijer, and I wasn't able to connect with them, so we just continued to just push forward, and we went out and we purchased the food through the grant, and we always seek volunteers. We always seek out people who want to donate as well.
Now, this does seem like a temporary solution to a really much bigger problem. Olivia, what do you hope that this food pantry says to school officials, not just at Ferris, but other campuses?
Well, it's a need. And I think that that's something that's really important, that it shows the universities in our state alone that this is something that students need, that it is also, you know, important to bridge the gap between higher education and hunger. Just because you're into college does not mean, you know, you don't have other needs that need to be met. So even as far as students working two or three jobs and still being full time, there's something still missing there. And so even though we only provide a temporary solution, we just want to fill that that missing link for students.
Ferris State senior Olivia Johnson, who's the founder of the Student Emergency Food Pantry for Ferris Students. Olivia, thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Charter schools, publicly funded, privately run. Backers hail them as the way to keep public schools and public school teachers on their toes because of the choice, the competition. Here in Michigan, we have roughly 145,000 students in more than 300 charter schools. That's according to Education Trust Midwest. And a report they came out with earlier this year showed charter school enrollment in the 2014-2015 school year consisted of disproportionately minority and low-income students. Andre Perry has watched the charter school industry take root, especially in urban areas where the number of charter schools is growing at a faster rate than suburbs or rural areas. And he has seen it up close as the former founding dean of urban education at Davenport University in Grand Rapids and as the CEO of the Capital One University of New Orleans Charter Network. Andre Perry believes it is time for activists like the ones in the Black Lives Matter movement to pay more attention to charter schools. Andre Perry, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Education reformers say charter schools and the choice they represent, Andre, are the ways to force failing public schools to shape up. And certainly we've seen that in Detroit. So what do you make of what has played out with the rise of charter schools in urban areas like Detroit that have large low-income and minority populations?
Well, I say all the time that urban districts are treated like black and brown people. They're over-policed. They're broken up. They are experimented on. And I don't necessarily think that there's anything inherently wrong with charter schools. But over time, you've seen that many of the devices that are used to fix districts are similar to those that are used to, quote unquote, fix black people. And so I think there's been a disproportionate amount of effort to apply charter schools to black communities instead of allowing black communities to reform themselves.
How do you believe the reformers and the state legislators regard black communities and black urban districts?
I think it's clear that they're more willing to take on districts in ways that they would never do in suburban or rural districts. The data is pretty clear on this. The disproportionate amount of our charter schools are enrolled by black students, and that's by design, because initially it was to, quote unquote, help poor, low income and black children. Now, if you are really into education, then you're into providing a better educational product for anyone. But you just don't see this type of effort being applied on white communities. And it's really because that black folk don't have the same type of value as white folk. And so endeavors to help people, we're doing anything under the sun in order to, quote unquote, improve their lives. And so you see all the time that we can break up districts, we can fire teachers, we can suspend and expel students in the name of helping, just as the same way we've said we can improve or clean up crime on the streets while incarcerating black and brown people. These are not trade-offs that we should accept. But you see it over and over again in districts, urban districts, particularly ones that are already ravaged by a tragedy. I had the experience to work in both Louisiana and Michigan, where you have New Orleans and Detroit, both African-American cities, historic African-American cities with historic power bases. And I can tell you that the reason why you don't see as much pushback as you would is because the decentralization efforts that have occurred in both Detroit and New Orleans hindered black voice to speak on what is good for them. Again, many of the machinations that you see in districts aren't inherently bad. There's nothing necessarily wrong with a charter school. It's just a small governance change that actually, and if applied properly, can actually get schools closer to communities. But the way it's applied, it literally upends black power. There's a nefarious thread in the movement that specifically wants to break up districts.
And so the effect you see on black communities and neighborhoods is what?
Oh, I mean, whether it's New Orleans, Newark, Detroit, D.C., when we wanted to improve the teacher workforce and we removed collective bargaining, guess what? Black women were the primarily ones that felt the burden of those changes and were disproportionately let go in the process. You saw, and this is changing over time, but you saw special needs services not being applied in ways that to protect all children, suspension and expulsion on the rise. And all of these things were done in efforts to help the community. But at the same time, it eroded a black power base. And I can't say this enough. Black people don't necessarily need choice. They need power. The reason why black community schools are not doing well is because black communities are not doing well. So when you break up districts, when you disrupt school boards, you are eroding black power. There has to be a way for us to build capacity of black communities while improving schools.
So let me ask you about that, because you know that there are people saying, look, you know, fill in the blank. We'll talk about Detroit, who say Detroit's public schools have been failing. Student scores have been abysmal. Buildings are falling apart. The system is hemorrhaging money. It's unsustainable. So what do you believe that needs to be the answer? What should we do about really terrible schools?
But I think we put way too much weight on just education and not address all of these other sectors that are really eroding Black communities. I can't say this enough. The reason why Black children and Black schools are not doing well is because criminal justice is failing, because healthcare is failing, because public safety is failing, because of a whole slew of issues in the Black community. The reason why the Black Lives Matter movement is so important is because it can link all these factors together. So you can see the constellation of institutionalized racism that are impacting students' lives. Because this is what's happening all across the country. Yes, test scores are going up. Incarceration is too. Test scores are going up. Employment is not improving for Black communities. If you are authentically improving schools, then you should see changes in the workforce. We should be hiring Black and brown teachers. Those students should go on to college and come back to school. We've been in this for 20-something years now. And this idea that we're going to myopically and instrumentally improve schools to improve children's lives is just ridiculous. It is about having institutions improve the capacity of communities. And if we're not going to do that, then it's not worth doing.
Is that a matter of we need to spend more money?
No, it's not just money. I mean, I've been involved in a lot of different reform efforts where we've incubated talent, where we trained teachers, where we created new teacher pipelines. Why can't we do that for Black people in communities? Instead of incubating white communities and empowering white institutions in Black communities, why not build capacity of the ones that are already there? In New Orleans, we've literally poured billions in New Orleans to improve not only schools, but housing, criminal justice reforms, you name it. But 10 years later, we have 100,000 less Black people in New Orleans, and we are as poor as we were pre-Katrina. Something's not adding up. So yes, we're building capacity of white organizations to help communities, but there's something fundamentally wrong with that picture. If we're pouring money into the organizations and people who need it, who are more likely to stay in the communities, who are already there, who absolutely need the training. But I can't tell you enough. We've moved to this place of we're going to do to the communities and do what's good for them instead of addressing what got us into this mess in the first place. And that was disempowerment of the Black community. We have got to empower the Black community. And this is not some radical thought, but let's give resources to the people who need it most, not to organizations that are built to help people. There is something fundamentally wrong with this picture, there's nothing innovative with this paternalistic type of reform. I mean, we can go back to Reconstruction and W.E.B. Du Bois and his views on the Freedmen's Bureau, where he believed that you could squeeze the self-determination out of people if you're constantly doing things to them. And similarly, the same thing is true in cities like New Orleans and Detroit, where we should be empowering people by literally giving them the capacity to do for self.
What would that look like, Andre? What do you think that would look like?
I mean, I can't say this enough. We need place-based scholarships where people who live in the hood can go to public universities. We need incubation sites where folks can learn how to run their own charter schools. We need to train people on how to run for public office. We need to actually stop suspending and expelling Black children, because that's where the broken teacher pipeline starts, because kids leave school not liking school. There are so many basic things that we should be doing instead of providing millions of dollars to white-led organizations to help Black people that does not address the power issue. that black communities are suffering from. It is, I mean, this constant idea that black people are broken and they need to be fixed. No, black people don't have power. They don't have the capacity to uplift themselves. We have smart people. They're no different than anyone else in the community. They need training. They need incubation. They need support. Give it to them.
Andre Perry's piece on why the Black Lives Matter movement has to take on charter schools can be found at theroot.com. Andre Perry joined us via Skype. It was great talking with you, Andre. We want to thank you so much for taking time to be on Stateside.
Hey, anytime.